the punchline.
He knocked the fuck out of Alistair Overy.
It almost seems like it should be impossible.
Hey everybody, welcome to the UFC 223 Ferguson versus Khabib breakdown. It's going to take place April 7th in Brooklyn, New York. And if you are not excited for this fight, you are not a fight fan. This card is stacked the whole way through. I mean, even the fight pass prelims are going to be headlined by Alex Caceres and Artem Lobov. On the prelims, you've got Evan Dunham, Oliver Abel Mercier, Joe Lozon, Ray Borg, Carolina Kowalkiewicz. I mean, the card is stacked the whole way through. These are just the prelims. We'll get to the main card here in a bit. But first, let's get through some news. Darren Till is supposed to be fighting Wonderboy in Liverpool May 27th. Whether or not, I'm not 100% on whether or not that's true, because I think this fight was supposed to happen before, and the same kind of thing happened, right? Where, like, Darren Till said it was happening, and, like, you thought it was a real thing, and then you found out that Wonderboy never accepted the bout. So until there's confirmation that Wonderboy's accepted, I'm going to be a little bit skeptical, but if this fight does happen, it's an excellent matchup, because these might be the two best technical strikers in 170-pound division. And it's kind of a question of whether this is a little bit too much too soon for Darren Till, right? Because Stephen Wonderboy Thompson has been in with some of the best in the world, including, like, Tyron Woodley, Jorge Masvidal. I mean, the list goes on, right? And obviously, Darren Till doesn't think that. He's thinking like a champ. Like, he has aspirations to win a title in, like, three different divisions, or so he says, right? So he's just looking at Wonderboy as a stepping stone to get his name thrust into the title contention talk. And a win would definitely do that. Like, no doubt, if you beat Wonderboy, you're probably a fight away from fighting for the title, if not fighting for the title. I mean, that would be a massive, especially if he could do it in dominant fashion. It would depend on how he won. But this is an extremely risky fight for Wonderboy, because Darren Till is young, he's dangerous, and he is, I mean, very skilled. And an excellent opportunity for Darren Till. So props to Wonderboy if he does end up taking this fight. This is a big fight. It's going to be an exciting one, because it's probably going to be, they're probably going to stand up and trade, right? And it's going to answer who's the best striker in the division, essentially. Like, that's what we're going to find out if these guys actually fight on May 27th. Speaking of the 170-pound division, Colby Covington is supposedly fighting Rafael Dos Anjos for the interim title at UFC 224. And I don't have a problem with this fight. I think this is actually an excellent fight, but what I do have a problem with is the fact that they keep slapping interim belts on everyone. Like, stop doing that. Because here's what irritates me more than anything. This really pisses me off. They don't want to add any more divisions because they're afraid of, like, it becoming like boxing and the sport getting watered down, blah, blah, blah. And the titles won't mean as much, blah, blah, blah. But then you're slapping interim belts on people. Like, you're contradicting yourself. Right now, we already have to keep track of what? How many divisions are there in the UFC? 11 or something like that? I'm just throwing a number out off the top of my head. But if you added a weight class every 10 pounds, you would essentially be adding, like, what? Two or three more divisions or something like that, I think. It wouldn't be a whole lot more. But when you slap interim belts on people, now you're forcing people to keep track of the hardcore MMA fans and people who follow the UFC religiously. They already know who these fighters are, and they know who's good. These interim belts are more for, like, a business move, right? To kind of sell fights, because so that you can slap a title fight on your billboards and stuff so that you can sell. But what you're doing, if your argument is that the sport is going to get watered down by more weight classes, then why are you forcing people to keep track of two champions and trying to determine who's the real champion? You know what I mean? Like, you're forcing them to actually keep track of more champions by adding interim belts. Because if you have to keep track of two for every fucking division that you have open, why not just open up more weight classes? Like, how it's contradictory to me. I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I won't harp on it for too long, but it's fucking stupid. Also, according to Dana White, TJ Dillashaw versus Demetrius Johnson is off. How true that is, it's so hard to tell, because Dana could have had a conversation with one of them, and something, negotiations might went a little bit astray. And really, I didn't read into it or anything. I just saw the headline, right? But my guess would be that, like, that wasn't actually said between the two of them. Something just went off, and Dana went out and announced, like, it's not happening anymore, right? He's kind of like a kid in that aspect. I don't know. I don't want to talk shit on him, because Dana White really has done so much for the sport. And MMA wouldn't be where it is without him. I mean, plain and simple, it wouldn't. He transformed the UFC and made it. He made it into what it is today. But sometimes, man, that guy, he just says some things that I don't always believe. But anyway, that's disappointing because TJ Dillashaw versus Demetrius Johnson would have been, A, it would have been an excellent matchup, and B, it would have answered the question of how good is the 125-pound division really? Because I think a lot of the times we discredit Demetrius Johnson a little bit because the guys who are fighting at 125, Demetrius beats them so handily that we just assume that the 125-pound division, like the competition's just not that good. When really, if you exclude Demetrius, they're all very competitive within themselves. And at 135 pounds, the belt has changed hands a few times. Like, we kind of have an established, like, we know who's good up there, right? Like, you got Dominic Cruz, Cody Garbrandt, TJ Dillashaw. Like, those guys are the elite of the elite up there. Jimmy Rivera's up there, too. He's very good. But TJ holds the belt at 135. And if he bumped down to 125 and Demetrius Johnson could pick up a win over him in dominant fashion, I feel like we'd respect him a little bit more. It's important to figure out how good the 125-pound division is, and it's important for Demetrius Johnson to kind of, like, earn the respect that he should have already earned, right? But, like, for whatever reason, I don't know. Like, I feel like we don't give him enough credit for what he's been able to accomplish. And he's not as big of an icon in the sport as he should be. I mean, he's one of the most fantastic talents that we've ever seen enter the octagon. He might be the most fantastic talent that we've ever seen. And this really would have helped to answer some questions and solidify, like I said, how good is that 125-pound division? Is Demetrius just fighting people that he's clearly leagues ahead of? Or is he just that far ahead of everyone, including people in other divisions? I don't know. If it doesn't happen, we'll never find out. I wish it would. I think it's one of the best matchups, honestly. I mean, there are a lot of good fights that have happened throughout UFC history, but this is one of the most interesting matchups to me in UFC history. And I personally, I like watching little guys fight because they rely so much on technique, you know? Not that big guys don't, but the cardio's all there for the little guys. And like when you're a big guy and you get someone on the ground, like you saw it in Stipe versus Francis, when you're that big, you can weigh on people, and little guys can't really do that as often, so you have to rely on being technically sound a little bit more. Anyway, let's jump right into this main card. The first fight on the card is going to be between number 10 ranked Ally Aquinta and Paul Felder, who hasn't cracked the top 15 just yet, and that just speaks testaments to how good the 155-pound division is and how deep it is. All right, let's start with Ally Aquinta. His last three fights, he's won three fights in a row. Both of these guys have. Most recently, he knocked out Diego Sanchez in the first round after a pretty long layoff. He was out for like 2 years. And before that, he beat Jorge Masvidal, who has since moved to 170 pounds. And that was a fight that Ally Aquinta, he looked smaller than Masvidal. And I mean, it makes sense that Masvidal bumped up to 170 after seeing that fight. He dealt with some adversity in that fight, right? He got rocked in the first round. I wouldn't say he was saved by the bell, but things weren't exactly going all that well either. So, but the point is he rebounded, came back, picked up a split decision win. Very composed in the second. That's so big, right? Like when you get rocked like that and you lose a round, it's so telling of what a fighter's like mentality is like when they come out and how they react to that in the next round. Sometimes you just can't help it. Sometimes you're just rocked, but like, it was good to see that Ally Quintus' confidence wasn't broken after a round like that. And before that, he knocked out Joe Lozon in the second round. That was a fight where Lozon, I felt like he controlled most of the fight, but Ally Quintus is a guy who, like, he might take a little bit to warm up, but once he gets into that rhythm, man, he's very hard to slow down, and he's very, very good. So he's won three in a row, right? I mean, when I do these, I always go through the last three fights because it's kind of a case of, like, what have you done for me lately, right? Like, what have you shown me that is going to help me decide, like, who's going to win this fight? And I'm wrong half the fucking time anyway, but I try to, like, look at – because, like, there are a lot of guys – Rose Namajunas, who we're going to talk about later, is a good example. There are people who have, like, losses early on in their career – But the sport evolves, and it's good to watch people's most recent fights because it gives the, it shows you how they're evolving along with the sport and how they confront new challenges, right? And how they've been doing lately, right? It's all about you're only as good as your last win. I mean, at least according to most of the fans and the way they book fights, right? So he's won three in a row, but actually he's on a five-fight win streak, and his other two wins were over Ross Pearson and Rodrigo Dam. His last loss was to Mitch Clark, but also keep this in mind, Ally Quinta has beat Kevin Lee, who recently fought Tony Ferguson for the interim title and had a pretty good showing against him. He ultimately lost, but he looked good. He has a wrestling background, and he's an Ultimate Fighter vet. He lost a finale to Michael Chiesa, by the way, who's also fighting on this card. He's fighting Anthony Pettis. We'll talk about that next. That's also a good fight. But Ally Quinta is going to be fighting a guy in Paul Felder, who has been extremely active lately. I mean, his last three fights, December 2nd, 2017, July 16th, 2017, and February 19th, 2017. So he's got three fights in 2017, whereas Ally Quinta last fought April 22nd of 2017, but then before that hadn't fought in 2 years. And I mean, you're probably going to find a common theme as I do these, but I tend to lean towards fighters who are active because, as I just mentioned earlier, the fight game is always evolving, and the guys who are in there and actually competing, I feel like they have an upper hand most of the time, right? And just because they're seeing it all the time, like they're seeing new things that are being implemented and like they're facing opponents more often, like staying active is important. And Paul Felder's last three wins have been over Charles Oliveira, Stevie Ray, and Alessandro Ricci. And those are, especially Oliveira, if you look at the trouble that Felder was in the first round, it's so impressive that he got out of there because Oliveira on the ground, he's a wizard. And Felder just stayed calm, like used fundamental defensive jiu-jitsu, survived the round, and then came out and picked up a knockout in the second. And I feel like Oliveira probably burned himself out a little bit in that fight, right? And also, keep this in mind, in that fight, Felder ate a nasty illegal knee. Like, if that's not a testament to how tough this guy is, I don't know what is. He's a guy out of Philadelphia. I'm going with him in this fight. I think it's going to be a decision win, but first off, I have a bias towards him because he's from PA, right? And he is, I really like the fact that he's been active lately, and it makes me nervous that Ally Quinta had his first fight in 2 years in April of 2017. Now it's been almost another year since he's fought. I just think that the game evolves too much to be taking time like that off, and against a guy like Felder, who is very high level and just beat Charles Oliveira and escaped probably the most dangerous positions that Oliveira could have put him in the first round. Like, I like that tenacity and stuff. So I'm going with Felder on this one. I think it'll be a decision. I think it's going to be hard to finish Ally Quinta because he's a tough motherfucker, but I mean, this is a very evenly matched fight, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if Ally Quinta won, but I just think that Octagon Rust, for the most part, is real. Guys like Dominic Cruz say it's not, but Dominic Cruz is a fucking freak of nature as well, so yeah, I'm going with Felder. But this is a close fight. Every fight on this card is close. Let's move on to Michael Chiesa versus Anthony Pettis. And this is a good fight, too, because these are two guys who are kind of built similarly, right? Like, they got kind of the same frame, probably close to the same height. And both of these guys are coming off losses. Michael Chiesa, most recently, to Kevin Lee, he got tapped out in the first round in that controversial win that, whether Lee should have won or not, I don't know. I feel like he was going to win, but Chiesa never tapped. And when Lee let go of the choke after Yamasaki stopped it, Chiesa kind of bounced up and was like, what the fuck? I never tapped. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he was with it. He was completely with it. So I don't know if he was about to go out. It looked like he was. It looked like he was in danger. But either way, he lost the fight. Fight stayed on his record. And Anthony Pettis is coming off a loss against Dustin Poirier. And that took place in Norfolk. I don't know. I always thought it was Norfolk, and then I moved down here, and I'm pretty sure the people down here pronounce it Norfolk. Norfolk, Virginia. Fucking weird. Anyway, Pettis is a guy who, when he fights, it's, I hate to say this about a fighter, and because I know the work that they put in and everything, but like, you can break Pettis' confidence. And you saw it in the Eddie Alvarez fight, you saw it in the Max Holloway fight, you kind of saw it in the Dustin Poirier fight. Like, I know he broke a rib, but he's a guy who, if you can really start pouring it on, you can like break his will. And I think it's like a mental game that he plays with himself. Like, he starts to doubt himself and his abilities, because he's extremely well-rounded, excellent striking background, and most people, I think, of when they think of Anthony Pettis, think of his flashy striker, and think about his knockouts against guys like Benson Henderson in WEC, where he, you know, the Showtime kick, where he jumped off the fence, kicked Ben Henderson in the face, and knocked him out. But really, Pettis is extremely savvy off of his back. He has like 9 submission wins and 7 knockouts. He actually has more submissions than he has knockouts. And he's fighting a guy in Chiesa who is a kind of a ground specialist, right? Chiesa has 10 fights in the UFC, and 10 of his 14 wins overall have come from submissions. So, are you going to be able to do that against Anthony Pettis? Because I think on paper, a lot of people might look at this fight and think, oh, Chiesa has an advantage on the ground, and I really don't think he does. I think that Pettis has one of the most underrated ground games in the lightweight division and in the UFC in general. He is so good off his back, and I don't think that he'll be able to submit Pettis. I really don't. So I think right there, you're already talking about one of Chiesa's most effective weapons being taken away from beating Pettis, right? Like, one of the things that you would expect him to be able to implement well, I really don't think he'll have a lot of success doing. What people do have success doing is getting in close and not giving Pettis distance, because he is, I mean, he's a Taekwondo black belt. Like, if you give him space, he's going to dot you up. But Chiesa might have a problem getting in close like that, because he's a little bit of a longer frame. And I think that the distance that these two are going to fight at is going to really benefit Pettis. And when it goes to the ground, I think that Pettis is going to be much harder to deal with than Chiesa might anticipate. I mean, maybe not. Maybe Chiesa's ready for all that, and maybe Chiesa's jiu-jitsu really is better than Pettis's, but I think it's going to be very hard to outwork Pettis on the ground. I'm leaning pretty heavily towards Pettis on this fight. If I'm Chiesa, I try to turn this into a dirty fight and get in close and work up against the fence a lot. Maybe land some takedowns from there and try to stay on top. But like I said, Pettis is good off his back too. Pettis has a very good ground game. People sleep on it sometimes, and I wonder if that's why they get tapped sometimes. Maybe if you don't sleep on it so much, you won't. But, I mean, he armbarred Benson Henderson. And I don't know. I have a hard time picking Chiesa in this fight. And I know that Anthony Pettis hasn't looked like himself as of late. Like, you look at his fights against guys like I said, like Eddie Alvarez, and you kind of see him like, and Rafael Dos Anjos, where like when you start putting the pressure on him, he really has a hard time dealing with it. And I think it's all up here. And I think this is a good fight. He had a good win over Jim Miller, where he was starting to look like himself, letting some stuff fly. But like I said, I think with Chiesa's frame and size is going to let Pettis work at a distance. And I think it's going to be, A, it's going to be hard for Chiesa to get a takedown. And B, when he does take him down, I think it's going to be very hard to do anything against Pettis on the ground. I'm going with Pettis on this one. Whether he'll get the finish or not, I don't know. It depends on what Anthony Pettis shows up. Pettis could show up, and like I said, he's so hit or miss, right? Like, there are nights when he shows up and you're like, oh my god, like if he fought like that every time, he'd never lose. And then he has those nights where it's like, I don't know, he doesn't look like that guy who was, you know, coming up through the ranks and, like I said, beat guys like Benson Henderson and Cowboy Cerrone and just like laying into people and looked almost untouchable, right? Hasn't been the case lately. So it'd be nice to see him get back to form, but I'm a big fan of both of these guys. I just think that the advantage is going to lean in Pettis' direction. Let's move on to the next fight, which is going to take place in the featherweight division between number 11 ranked Renato Moicano and number 13 ranked Calvin Kattar. And this is a very good fight. This might be fight of the night. If I had to pick one for fight of the night, this would be my guess. Moicano most recently lost to Brian Ortega. And in a fight that, if that fight goes to the judges, he probably wins. And I don't. So he landed a take. He was dotting up Ortega through most of the second round, like looked really good on his feet, and then took him down with about 10 seconds left or so, which is smart, right? Because for whatever reason, when you take guys down at the end of a round, it seems to it sticks with the judges more, right? And it tends to convince them to put the round in your favor for whatever reason. And I think that's for a couple reasons, right? I think that's because when you land a takedown at the end of a round, not only is it the last thing that happened, that, like I said, it kind of sticks with them, right? But also, it kind of exemplifies, like, if the fight were to end right now, who would have the advantage at the end of the fight, right? Because the end of the round kind of simulates, like, the end of the segment of a fight. So if you can control the end of that segment, I think that we have a tendency to think, like, oh, that was more important than the rest of the round. So the second round takedown, very well advised and probably a smart move, but I thought he was winning the third round too, but then he took Ortega down and Ortega locked up a guillotine. And Ortega is so maybe the best in the world off his back. And I think he shot with like 2 or 3 minutes left. And that's just, I don't think that's a smart move. Maybe he was feeling confident after he landed that takedown so easily in the second round. And like he was winning on the feet and maybe he was trying to make a statement, but it was a mistake either way. And it cost him his first professional loss. Before that though, we're talking about a guy who beat Jeremy Stephens. Very close fight, split decision, right? And Jeremy Stephens was ranked number 5 at the time. So, I mean, that's a pretty big win, split decision or not. And before that, he had another split decision over Zubaira Tukugov, right? And that was a pretty back-and-forth fight, but I agree with the decision on this one. I mean, I don't think it should have been split. I say that, but I also wouldn't want to be a judge, right? Like, I talk shit on them a lot, and some of the decisions are ludicrous, but this would have been a little bit of a tougher fight to call. I felt like Moicano, I thought that he definitely won the fight, but I guess I could see how you could argue the other way with this one, so I won't harp on it too much. Fun fact, this is a guy who picked up a UFC win, his first UFC win, sorry. On 10 days notice, and he finished the guy, which anytime you do that, I mean, obviously impressive, and it's going to start getting you bigger fights. And like I said, the only blemish on his record so far has been Brian Ortega, and Brian Ortega hasn't exactly slipped up yet. So, but his striking is very, and here's one of the things that I like about Moicano a lot. He's good at fighting backwards, and he knows when to apply pressure. Like, if you watch the Ortega fight, he was throwing a lot of combos, like, moving forward a lot. But in the Jeremy Stephens fight, he was kind of doing the opposite. He was moving backwards and countering. So it shows you that he's willing to adapt his game depending on the opponent that he's fighting, which is important if you're going to start fighting some of these higher-ranked guys. And Calvin Kattar's a guy who only has 2 fights in the UFC so far, but he's got a win over the highly touted Shane Burgos. Like, people thought he was going to be one of the next big things, and he knocked him out in the third round. And before that, he picked up a unanimous decision win over Andre Feely in a fight that he really kind of controlled and dominated the whole entire time. One of the things that Calvin Kattar does really well that I like is he finishes rounds really well. We were just talking about how Moicano pulled that off in the second round against Brian Ortega. Kattar seems to do this in every single round. He, like, either damages you, like, he lands a big shot, or he takes you down. Like, these are going to be two guys who have very high fight IQs for the limited amount of experience that they have in the UFC. I think this is going to be, I don't know if it's a sleeper, really, because it's right before the co-headliner, but I think that this is a hell of a fight, and I think that, like I said, I think this has fight of the night potential, and I would guess that most of this fight would stay on its feet because Moicano likes to throw, and I think Kattar. So I'm picking Kattar in this fight, and this is what I think is going to happen. I think that Kattar is going to start off, and he's going to have a quick start, and it's going to kind of force Moicano. It's going to kind of be back and forth, right? But I think that when I say he'll have a fast start, I mean, like, I think he'll be getting a little bit better at the exchanges, and I think Kattar's going to be a little bit more powerful. And I think that those shots that Moicano reading are going to start to tally up. And Moicano is going to shoot for a takedown because most of his finishes, all of his finishes actually, now that I think about it, have come via submission. So, and Kattar is very good on the feet. So I think that's going to be pretty evenly contested at first, but Kattar is just going to be landing a little bit more powerful shots and it's going to kind of wear on Moicano. And Moicano is going to shoot for a takedown. He's not going to be able to get it. Because if you look at Kattar, I mean, according to the UFC stats that I have pulled up, at least, he's never been taken down, 100% takedown defense. So I think that Moicano is going to have a tough time wrestling him down to the mat. And I think that Cater's strength and the power that he has in his punches might just be a little bit too much for Moicano to deal with. Moicano throws some very smooth combinations, though. Like, this is such a hard fight to pick. Every fight on this card is. I mean, these are so evenly contested. Yeah, I'm going to go with Cater. Moicano throws some really smooth combinations, though, and he does a really good job of throwing that, like, especially his hooks. And when he starts letting them fly, like, when he lets his hands fly, he's fast and he's crisp and he's very accurate. I just think that Cater's going to... I think there's going to be a power difference. And I think that when they get into these exchanges, Moicano's going to have success landing. But like I said, I think that the shots that Cater's going to land are just going to be a little bit more significant. And it might give him the edge in this fight. I don't know. Also, I like the fact that, I mean, Shane Burgos, I think, was 11-0 when Cater fought him. And Cater went through a period where he missed like 2 years due to a hand injury. And when he first started off his career, he was picking up a lot of finishes, right? And then all of a sudden he went through a spell where he was winning decisions and stuff, which is fine. He was still winning, but like the finish wasn't there. And it makes you wonder if that win over Burgos is kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? It makes you wonder if it kind of symbolizes that the finishes are coming again, right? Because this is a guy who, like I said, throughout the beginning of his career, that's what he was doing. He was finishing guys, and doing it most recently might have got him some of his mojo back. And I'm looking for like a second or third round knockout by Cater, because Moicano is very good on the ground. I think if it does go to the ground, Moicano will have the advantage, but I don't know. In the fights that I've seen from Cater, I really like him in this. But very close fight. All right, now we're moving on to the co-headliner in a rematch between Rose Namajunas and Joanna Jędrzejczyk. Obviously, the first fight, Rose won in spectacular fashion and in a way that I don't think anyone in the world really expected her to win that way, right? She knocked her out and dropped her once. Joanna got back up, and you could tell that when Joanna got back up, she was affected by getting knocked down, obviously. I mean, you just got fucking clipped and put on the ground. And she was moving backwards, and Rose smelled blood, pushed forward, and landed the shot that knocked her down again. And then I think Joanna submitted, tapped out the strikes. And Rose really kind of flipped that whole entire division on its head, because first off, she was an underdog going in there. And if anyone thought she was going to win, they thought it would be in these mad scrambles where Rose was on the ground and was able to submit Joanna. And that wasn't the case. She just knocked her the fuck out. But Rose is a girl who's also relatively new. And you're going to find this with a lot of girls and a lot of women, just because it's a little bit newer. But she's only 8-3. Her most recent loss has come against Karolina Kowalkiewicz back in 2016. And in a fight that she didn't look bad in, it was just like one of those cases where it was a little bit too much too soon, right? Before that, she had a loss to Tisha Torres, I think, in another organization, I think Invicta. And then she also lost to Carla Esparza fighting for the inaugural strawweight championship. And again, just kind of a case of like Esparza was just a little bit too much for her. And Esparza's grappling was much more developed than Rose's, and I don't think Rose had just ever seen that yet in that moment, and she was very young. And I mean, what a turnaround she's had since then, right? Knocking out Joanna in Madison Square Garden, right? In the biggest fight of your life. So if that doesn't speak testaments to how Rose has matured throughout the years and how she's grown as a mixed martial artist, I don't know what does. All right, so last three fights, obviously, win over Joanna. Then I mentioned that she had a loss to Karolina Kowalkiewicz, but in between there, she beat Michelle Waterson and tapped her out in the second round with a rear naked choke. I mean, Rose has very, like, sneaky jiu-jitsu. Like, I thought that Michelle was going to have the advantage on the ground going into that, and I was wrong. Like, Rose is, she's very flexible. She has a very good understanding of positions and where she needs to go, and it feels like she's always a step ahead of you on the ground, right? The only area that I've really seen her struggle with, other than when you go back to her Carla fight, like she got out grappled, but I think she's grown a lot since then, and I think if that fight took place again, it would be a different story. But anyway, when she fought Karolina, she struggled in the clinch a little bit, right? Like Karolina was getting off some elbows and some nice knees, but I've been harping on this for the however long I've been talking about it now, but Rose is one of those people who adapt and she evolves. So I would guess that problem that she had in the clinch, I would guess that she's addressed that by now. If I'm Joanna, I'm going to test that a little bit. Like, I'm going to, because Joanna's very good in the clinch. And when Joanna fought Carolina and beat her, Joanna kind of had the advantage in the clinch, right? Like, Joanna's a very credentialed Muay Thai artist. I think she... I have it written down here. One sec. Oh, yeah. 5-time gold medalist from 2009 to 2013 in IFMA, which is, I believe, International something Muay Thai Amateur. I don't know what the fuck it stands for. I guess I could look it up. But 5-time gold medalist, amateur Muay Thai champion, right? Like, she's got experience striking, and when she fights people, it's very evident that there's a gap between how good Joanna is and how good they are. Like, her technical striking, you gotta almost turn it into a brawl. And what's more impressive is that Rose didn't really do that. Rose just clipped her with a clean left hand. All right, so Joanna's last three fights, obviously lost to Rose. Before that, she picked up over a win over Jessica Andrade, and before that, beat Carolina Kowalkiewicz, which I just mentioned. The win over Andrade was impressive because if you look at Andrade, she used to fight at 135, and she's this, like, kind of a little bit shorter, but powerful, stocky, and she stalks people. Like, she's very aggressive, and she's pushing forward, and she sets a relentless, a very ferocious pace that most people in that division just can't keep up with. And Joanna was able to. And not only was Joanna able to keep up with it, but she was able to outpace Andrade. So, I mean, one of the big advantages that I think Joanna has going into this rematch is that Rose has never gone all five rounds. And Joanna has on different occasions, right? Against Andrade, against Kowalkiewicz, and you can have some success early against Joanna, and Rose did and was able to capitalize on it, but one of the things that Joanna is so good at is just being able to withstand and keep up her pace throughout the fight, and eventually you can't keep up with her. I'm going with Joanna in this fight, actually. I think Rose has an excellent chance to win again. I mean, she's already done it once, right? She's obviously riding the confidence. She's got going in there with that, like, high, like, you know, you already beat this person once, and they're the one who has to adapt to you. Like, they have to figure you out this time around because you already figured them out before. But Joanna has so much background in, like, the striking department, and I just think that, like, over the course of five, I think this fight's going to go the distance this time, and I think over the course of five rounds, Rose is going to start to fade a little bit after the third. I think that Joanna's going to put that pace on, be a little bit more cautious about her striking. And when Rose starts to fade, Joanna's going to kick it into overdrive and really dominate the championship rounds in 4 and 5. Again, I could be wrong. We don't know what Rose looks like for 5 rounds, right? We've never seen it before. So, I mean, if it does go the distance, we're going to find out how Rose handles a 25-minute fight as opposed to a 15-minute one. But I like Joanna as the rounds fade on. Just because we haven't seen it from Rose yet, right? I could be completely wrong. I don't know. Like, I'm just guessing, but I know that Joanna can keep that pace up. I know that for a fact, that she can maintain that pace for 25 full minutes without missing a beat. And when her opponents start to slip up, those are the moments that Joanna capitalizes on. So I have a hard time picking Rose again. Not that I picked her before. I mean, I just have a hard time thinking that she's going to win this fight. It's very hard to beat the same person twice, I think. But on the flip side, it's very hard to go back and fight someone who's already beat you, and you know they've already beat you, right? Like, it's such a mental game. I've gone back and forth on almost every single fight in this. I'm sticking with Joanna. I'm thinking Joanna unanimous decision. If she does get a finish, I don't think it'll be until, like, the fourth or fifth round. Like I said, I think Rose is going to start to fade, and it won't be. I don't think it'll be this, like, massive drop off where you're like, oh, what the fuck is Rose doing? Like, she's all tired all of a sudden. I think it's just going to be like, Joanna's output will be a little bit more than Rose's, and Rose won't quite be able to keep up with what Joanna's throwing at her. All right, let's move on to, finally, the main card between the interim champ Tony Ferguson and number 2 ranked Khabib Nurmagomedov. And this is a fight that I've been looking forward to maybe more than, I don't want to say any fight ever, but this is any fight this year, undoubtedly, and within recent memory, right? Like, this is... We're about to find out who probably the two best hundred, who the best 155 pounder ever is. Like, that's what we're about to find out this weekend. And Tony Ferguson is a guy who has rattled off 10 wins in a row now. In his last three, he's beat Kevin Lee, Rafael Dos Anjos, Lando Venata. He's also beaten Edson Barboza, Josh Thompson, Gleison Tibau, Abel Trujillo, Danny Castillo. I mean, the list goes on, right? Like, this guy, we're talking about a guy who has proven himself against the most elite fighters in the 155 pound division. And the only guy who he hasn't really gone through yet is Khabib Nurmagomedov, who is 25-0 and has most recently picked up a win over Edson Barboza, and then beat Michael Johnson before that, and before that beat Daryl Horcher. And he's a guy who hasn't really faced any adversity in his career. Except I can think of two times when he was fighting Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson clipped him in the first round and had him in serious danger of being knocked out. And then when he fought Gleison Tibau, you could argue it either way. I thought he lost. I thought Tibau set a very good blueprint of how you beat Khabib. And if you look at what Khabib does really well, his takedowns all stem from pushing you up against the fence, taking away an escape route, and then just wearing on you and smothering you and getting the fight to the floor somehow. If you can prevent that, I mean, people haven't been able to do it yet. Gleison Tibau did kind of. I mean, Gleison Tibau, like I said, he set a blueprint and he exemplified excellent takedown defense in that fight. But most other people just aren't able to do it. But you've got a guy in Tony Ferguson who moves a lot, strikes from extremely awkward angles, black belt in 10th planet jiu-jitsu under Eddie Bravo, which is arguably the most effective form of jiu-jitsu for MMA. I don't want to say that Tony's going to have any type of advantage on the ground, because Khabib hasn't given us a reason to believe that he has any weaknesses on the ground, really. But it'll be interesting to see, if the fight does go to the ground, what Tony is able to do off his back. Because as I mentioned, he's a legit 10th planet black belt, and he is always attacking off his back. He's very offensive. He's very unorthodox. And he does a good job at utilizing elbows to set submissions up and stuff. And I'm going to give the advantage on the ground to Khabib, just because, like I've said, when he's gotten it there, we haven't seen many people who've been able to stop it yet. But maybe Tony's going to be that guy. On the feet, I got to give it to Tony. I just think that Tony is so, like I said, he's so weird. And he's coming from all these different angles, and he's uber aggressive. I mean, he is in your face, and he's moving forward, and it's very hard to predict what he's going to throw. And when you can't get a read on someone, it's very hard to start countering them and stuff, right? And I don't think Khabib's the guy who's going to rely on countering a lot. You know what Khabib wants to do. Khabib wants to get this against the fence, drag it to the ground, and smother you for five rounds or however long it takes to get a submission or a knockout. This is such a good fucking fight. And when I get through these, so I make like a list. I have like the last three fights and some additional info that I want to talk about and stuff written down. And I always highlight like who I think is going to win, and I don't have anyone highlighted for this because I was just going to make it up on the spot, and I'm still struggling to pick a winner. I do know that Tony Ferguson, both of these guys are lifelong athletes in their own respect, right? Like, Khabib's a guy who's been wrestling since he was like 6 years old, literally wrestling bears and shit, right? Started training in combat sambo when he was 17. He gold medaled in combat sambo a couple times in Moscow and Kyiv. Am I pronouncing that right? And Tony's a guy who, believe it or not, was a starting defensive back for his football team when they won the state championship. He went on to wrestle at Central Michigan before transferring to Grand Valley State. And he won a National Collegiate Wrestling Association championship there in 2006. He won season 13 of Tough. And both of these guys have a pretty... The records are kind of the same, right? Like, Tony has... He's 25-3. Khabib's 25-0. Tony has 9 knockouts, 9 submissions, and 5 decisions. And Khabib has 8 knockouts, 8 submissions, and 9 decisions. Here's one thing that will play into Tony's advantage if the fight goes the distance. Khabib has never been in a 5-round fight. And Tony Ferguson has against Rafael Dos Anjos. And it didn't go 5 rounds, but he was against Kevin Lee. So he's prepared for it twice and actually gone the distance once. And Rafael dos Anjos is no joke. And I mean, both of these, Khabib's beat Rafael dos Anjos too. But I mean, just on paper, these two are so evenly matched. And obviously, like, you think the striking goes to Tony and the groundwork goes to Khabib, right? One thing that I do want to mention that I think that the reason that Tony Ferguson was taken down in the Kevin Lee fight is because Kevin Lee is extremely explosive. He has very quick movement, and he has a very good double leg, and he doesn't necessarily need to rely on the cage to take someone down. He doesn't rely on it as much. Not that Khabib needs to rely on it, but he definitely uses it to his advantage. And I think that, first off, like, Tony doesn't really care where the fight goes. Like, I don't think he wanted to be taken down, obviously. Like, no one wants to get picked up and slammed. But Lee is so fast and so explosive, and he doesn't really telegraph his takedowns. And he's good enough at striking that you have to worry about his striking, too. Khabib, you know what Khabib's going to do. Not that his striking is, like, piss poor or anything, but he wants to take this to the ground and make it a dirty fight and suffocate you. So I think that I'm leaning towards Tony on this fight. Because, like I said, you know what Khabib's going to do. He's going to try to push you up against the fence. And I think that if Khabib tries to shoot for Tony's legs or anything in the middle of the mat without having the fence to aid him, that he's going to have a very tough time getting Tony to the ground. If he pushes Tony up against the fence, if he's successful in pushing forward, then you got a different story in your hands. But I don't think that Tony's the type of guy who's going to be bullied backwards unless he gets rocked or something. You know what I mean? And I think that Tony has the advantage of standing up. So, oh boy, like, I've been going back and forth. Like, if Khabib can manage to put the pressure on Tony and keep Tony backing up, I think he'll win the fight. But I really don't know that he'll be able to. I think that Tony moves so awkwardly and so often, and he's usually used to being the aggressor in his fights. And I think he's going to start landing on Khabib early and make Khabib pay for the pressure that Khabib's normally able to put on people. Look for Tony to be, I would come out of the gates being super aggressive, because you don't want Khabib putting your back on the fence like he does to everyone else, right? I mean, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here talking about that, but I really think you can keep the advantage in your favor if you can be the one pushing forward, or at least being the one who's not being pushed backwards. So I'm going to go with Tony Ferguson on this one, and I think Tony's going to finish Khabib. I'm going third or fourth round knockout for Tony Ferguson. This is so close, though. Like, I'm obviously just taking a stab at this, but there's a legitimate chance that Khabib could come out and put on a grappling clinic on Tony like he's done against everyone else. I'm just leaning towards Tony because of his awkward movement. And like I said, when you're fighting a guy like Kevin Lee, the takedowns are there because Tony, like, you're dealing with the striking, and you're like, when he explodes, man, it's so hard to stop that shit. Like, it's very hard to stop Kevin Lee from taking you down because it's happening now. And with Khabib, you kind of know it's coming, and he's telegraphing it by constantly pushing you up against the fence, and I don't think Tony's going to let him do that. I think it's going to be very hard for Khabib to take Tony down, and Tony's a big guy, too. And I think that the reason I'm saying fourth round is because, like I said, Khabib's never been in a five-round fight, and I know that he struggles to make the weight. I know he's got a nutritionist and everything now, but he's still cutting a lot of weight to get down there. And I think that that's going to start to take a toll on him, especially if he can't stay on top of Tony. And even if he does take Tony down, I like Tony's survival skills, at least, to get out of a few rounds. And I don't know. It's going to be, I mean, this is going to be interesting. Definitely, probably the best fight of the year so far, at least on paper. And hopefully it plays out that way. Thinking about it, this is probably going to be your fight of the night if it plays out how I think it's going to. If Khabib doesn't smother Tony completely, then it'll probably be fight of the night. If not, like I said, I like Hanato Moicano and Calvin Kattar to take fight of the night. But I mean, Jesus, every fight on this main card has potential to take it, though, right? Like, Ally Quinta, Paul Felder, hell of a fight. Michael Chiesa versus Anthony Pettis, hell of a fight. Hanato Moicano versus Calvin Kattar, hell of a fight. Rose versus Joanna, hell of a fight. And Tony versus Khabib. I mean, what more can you ask for if you're a fight fan? It's going to be a very exciting weekend, and I am looking forward to it. Let me know what you guys think, and I will catch you later. Thank you for listening.